Thank you. And thank you for your interest on a late afternoon and a busy day. Let me first open up this whole thing. Here we are. So I wanted to talk about tuberculosis as a re-emerging but still neglected disease. And I thought I'd take the iceberg as something that illustrates the problem. Worldwide, about 2 billion people, about one-third of the total world population, is infected with the etiologic agent of tuberculosis, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. That's a lot. And it sounds very good that only a few percent of those who are infected will ever develop disease. So the iceberg in that case is a good news. That is, there are many more people infected than those who will develop disease. Yet about 10 million people every year will suffer from tuberculosis, newly acquired tuberculosis, and about 2 million will die of this disease. This makes Mycobacterium tuberculosis the number one killer amongst all infectious agents. That's the bad news. Perhaps it's also good news for you. That is that only 20 to 22 countries suffer from about 80% of all TB cases. So the vast majority of TB cases is centered in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and a few other countries. 171 countries that are members of the UN account for about 20% only of all TB cases. You know this map. This is a map that shows the world, and it shows it according to its size. Big countries are big, small countries are small, as we expected. You can also do this. You can also do this in appropriation in relation to those who are dying of a certain disease or who are having passenger cars. And what you see here is that clearly the relative abundance, that is the proportion of people who have a car, they live in the US, they live in Europe, and they live in Japan. Very different if you look at a map that looks at TB prevalences. Tuberculosis clearly is rare in Northern America, it's rare in Europe, and it's highly prevalent on the African continent, in India, and in China. Indeed, the African sub-Saharan Africa is the part of the world where more people suffer from tuberculosis than anywhere else. But China and India are the countries which have the most cases on a national basis. However, we shouldn't be too complacent. Look at these data, most recent data from London. Today, we account in this year, we think that about 3,500 to 4,000 people will develop tuberculosis in London. That's a 30% increase over the last decade. And it's a doubling of incidences of multi-drug resistance TB in the last year. Multi-drug resistance TB is a form of tuberculosis that can still be treated, but it's very difficult to treat. It is long-term treatment, and often it's a failure. In fact, actually, Europe is the area where treatment of tuberculosis is amongst the most unsuccessful. We count about 23% failures, 26% of loss to follow-up, 90% of deaths are amongst MDR-TB cases, and only one-third, 32% of the treatments is successful. Compare that with Eastern Europe, which has a lot more problems on MDR-TB, where about 50% success rate is counted. Let's go back 120 years or so, go back to Berlin, where I'm currently working. At that time, tuberculosis was the number one cause of death amongst all causes of death. It was about 12% amongst the total population, and about 40% amongst the working class, that is the people amongst between 25 and 40 years. This was also the high time of research, when diagnosis was developed by Robert Koch, when he described the etiology of tuberculosis, when prevention by a vaccine was developed by Calmette and Guérin in Lille, France, BCG, between 1906 and 1921. And in the 1950s then, when therapy was developed, by a number of researchers in the field of drug development, notably Salman Waksman in the US. However, it's embarrassing that these are still the methodologies of today in the developing world. Smear-positive sputum, as developed by Robert Koch, is still used in most widely in the developing world, and this is clearly insufficient because about 40 to 50% of all TB cases are not diagnosed. Vaccination. BCG protects newborn against serious forms of tuberculosis, but it's most likely totally unaffected against pulmonary TB of the adults, and that's the most prevalent form of this disease nowadays. Therapy isn't much better, and I already talked about MDR, multi-drug-resistant TB, and XDR, extensively drug-resistant TB, is even worse, and I won't go into more details. I would argue that our inability to control TB today is due to our neglect within the last quarter of the last century. Better measures based on scientific science and development are urgently needed. But please don't forget, if we develop something in the lab today, it will take at least 10, more likely 15 years before such a drug or vaccine will be available to the people who need it. Let me just illustrate that by figures. What you see here is the newly approved drugs in the last 25 years of the last century. And what you see is cardiovascular diseases, about 180 new drugs had been licensed. That's good, not to be misunderstood. That's very good. Respiratory non-infectious diseases, allergy and so on, about 90. Very good. However, look at TB or malaria. Three drugs had been developed, and actually these were not any new drugs. It was just some me-too drugs, that is, drugs that target the same molecular targets as other drugs that had already been developed before. Now, based on what I have told you by now, it sounds quite ambitious, and I think that's a quite friendly word, was the WHO has been proposed through the Stop TB Partnership. The World Health Organization, through Stop TB Partnership, its organization that's responsible for TB, has claimed to eliminate tuberculosis by the year 2050. That means less than one case amongst the 1 million inhabitants. In other words, if you consider about 8 to 9 people living on this globe by 2050, reduce tuberculosis from about 10 million to about 8,000 to 9,000 cases. That's very ambitious, that's very courageous. It can only be achieved, I think there is consensus on that, if we have new drugs, if we have new vaccines, and we have better diagnostics. I would like now to talk a little bit about vaccine development and then later on biomarkers, and I will focus now on our own studies. Currently, there are 12 new vaccine candidates that have entered clinical trials. Three of them are recombinant BCG that are aimed at replacing the current BCG. Remember, the current BCG is not helpful in preventing tuberculosis in adults. Actually, there's only one currently that's ongoing in a clinical trial. The other two are on hold. And that's ours, and I will discuss that in a minute. Seven new vaccine candidates are prime boost vaccine candidates that are either given on top of BCG or ideally, if we would have a better replacement for BCG, on top of this new vaccine. And then there are two vaccines that are from immunotherapy, and that is a shaky field. I won't go into that. Let me just explain very briefly without data what we decided to do. And this is based on immunology. This is a macrophage in a very simple scheme, a host effector cell, which is able and capable of eradicating many pathogens once the macrophage has engulfed them. However, Mycobacterium tuberculosis and the BCG vaccine survive in macrophages. They survive in a phagosome, which they arrest, and therefore, because of their residence in the phagosome, CD4 T cells are stimulated. CD8 T cells, in contrast, are very rarely stimulated. More recently, it was found that indeed Mycobacterium tuberculosis is able to aggress into the cytosol, and immunologically speaking, it now behaves It now behaves like a virus, and therefore CD8 T cells are also stimulated. BCG, however, remains in the phagosome. So the next step we thought is, why not take a gene encoding listeria lysine that allows BCG to either egress into the cytosol or allows antigens to go into the cytosol. And this was based on our finding that listeria lysine is expressed by Listeria monocytogenes, a pathogen, a rather mild pathogen, that indeed egresses into the cytosol and stimulates CD8 T cells. So we took the listeria lysine gene and added it to BCG. Now listeria lysine has a very stringent pH optimum. BCG neutralizes the phagosomal milieu, and therefore as a next step we had to delete urease. As you know, urease catalyzes production of ammonia, and therefore the phagosome remains rather neutral. By deleting urease, now you have a system that phagosomal acidification takes place, and therefore the listeria lysine becomes biologically active, allows leakage through a perforated membrane, antigens enter the cytosol, and therefore not only CD4 but also CD8 T cells are stimulated. More recent, that was the basis actually of our development of a vaccine candidate against tuberculosis. More recently, we found that we were right, but only half right. More recently, we found that listeria lysine perforates the membrane, correct, but because of the acidification, the phagosomes lyses with the lysosomes, and therefore lysosomal enzymes are entering this compartment, and because of perforation, they can also be released into the cytosol, and therefore cathepsins also are released into the cytosol, and that leads also to an apoptotic event, probably also to autophagy, and that allows therefore then for the formation of apoptotic blebs with antigenic cargo from mycobacterium, in this case BCG, and the CD4 T cells are stimulated, both of the Th1, Th17 type, and CD8 T cells. I'm not going into much details here, just to tell you this, in our opinion, is the right combination of T cells that you would like to stimulate. Where are we now? Now, this vaccine candidate was shown to be highly efficient. That is, it showed high protection, much better in a mouse system, which is the experimental animal system you normally start with. It's safe in immunocompromised animals, highly safe, much safer than BCG. We then licensed it to a small broker institution, I would call them Vaccine Project Management, VPM. Since listeria lysine comes from listeria monocytogenes, we had to get approval for a P1 level, that is the lowest level of a genetically modified organism, has been achieved. Then it was produced under good manufacturing practice, achieved. Safety toxicity in a number of animals that were required, achieved. And most recently, we got also rid of hygromycin that caused a few problems for us, but it's now a strain that's totally free of any antibiotic. And a phase one trial in Germany, the country of discovery and development, was successful. That's on safety. A second phase one trial in an area with high prevalence of TB, successful. And actually, as we talk here, the first newborn is being vaccinated in South Africa because the phase two trial has just started in newborns in South Africa. This is not the end of the road. We further improve the vaccine. We delete anti-apoptotic genes to improve the apoptosis and autophagy, which we consider extremely important. We construct a safer BCG that also can be given into HIV-positive individuals, notably HIV-positive babies. And we will also construct BCG that produce cytokines. That's the least priority. But we will also induce different antigens, which might be important if we think of prime boost vaccination strategies. Just to remind you, phase one, phase two, phase three is the requirement to get something through a clinical trial into individuals. And that is quite cumbersome. You need about 10 to 20 individuals per group in phase one. You go and do about 100 participants in a phase two. And in a phase three, because of the rather low prevalence of TB, not higher than 300 per 100,000, we calculated that we probably need about 25 to 30 individuals per study group in such a clinical trial, makes about 70 to 80,000 participants. since you want to do that in at least three different sites, sub-Saharan Africa, India, China, at that. So this is very cost efficient. So it has been calculated by a number of people that in the TB field, a vaccine, a phase three trial is about 150 or so million, $150 million, and that's a lot. Now, if you think about 12 vaccines are currently being developed, that's a lot, and it's most likely that by now we need to reduce the numbers, so we have to have stringent criteria which vaccine finally enters the clinical trial pipeline. One way to improve that all would be biomarkers, which could tell us today whether a vaccine works tomorrow. Biomarkers would be ideal also for diagnostic purposes, telling us who of the 2 billion individuals who are infected will develop disease later. So if we would have a prognostic biomarker, you could use that for a vaccine trial as a surrogate marker of clinical outcome. That is, reduced clinical outcome after vaccination is a good sign, gives you a positive sign for a vaccine candidate, and that could now allow you to combine experimental vaccine candidates at an earlier stage than after having passed the phase three clinical trial. So we decided to go into biomarker studies, and we do that with seven partners in Africa. Most of this is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I think Peter Singer just gave a talk about the grand challenges. This is one of the grand challenges, which is still ongoing. So what do we want to know with biosignatures or biomarkers? Biosignatures for me are just a number of selected biomarkers, a custom-made biosignature of those markers which are most promising. First of all, you want to distinguish tuberculosis from latent infection, the 2 billion infected versus the 10 million who develop disease every year. However, you want to use that in a reverse translation to better understand biology of tuberculosis. And then, as I already mentioned, we want to use this for monitoring of vaccine and drug trials. And that's the holy grail, of course, the holy grail. Ideally, you want biomarkers that predict today who of the infected individuals will develop disease in a later time, be it years or decades. So what we decided to do is, with our seven partners in sub-Saharan Africa, we compare, as a first step, the biomarkers of those who never become sick, although they are infected, that's the 2 billion, with those who develop serious tuberculosis, that's the 10 million every year. And we do this, and I will only describe two examples on the transcriptomic and the metabolomic level, but we do it also on the immunologic level, looking for antigen-specific T-cell responses. This is just to get us going. This is a typical heat map, doesn't tell us much. This is how it looks like if you compare patients with infected individuals. And I will just go immediately into the major biomarkers, which are the most robust ones. Fc gamma receptor, lactoferrin. Fc gamma receptor is binding Fc part of the immunoglobulin. That's not a real surprise. Lactoferrin is involved in iron uptake in host cells. Iron competition in TB is a major issue between host and pathogen, no surprise. GBPs, guanylate binding proteins, they're downstream of IFN signaling, wasn't expected but could make sense. Then effector molecules like the cytotoxic granzyme and the antimicrobial defensins. And finally, a very specific one, which we not really pursue anymore, Rab33A, a GDPase involved in the release of killer molecules from CD8 T cells. And this is the data you get in this case here. It's quite robust. In a first study in Germany, we could predict tuberculosis with 88% robustness, latent infection with about 90%. South Africa, if we take these markers, 94% TB prediction, 97% of all cases latent infection correct. Gambia, it was lower. However, if we add defensins, we are around 90%. So what I just wanted to tell you is that indeed, with a custom-made signature of about 5 to 10 markers, you can correctly predict those who are infected and healthy from those who are infected and have disease. So it works. Let me now come to the metabolome very briefly. This is another approach which we thought would be interesting. Analyze
about 420 to 450 small molecules in serum of patients and latent infected individuals. This is done with metabolone in the US, and what you see here, they identify in that particular study 428 molecules. Of those, 269 are named. That is, we have a name for the textbook, and about 159 are not named, but they have the spectrum, so they know it's a unique molecule, but it doesn't have a name in our language, but that's semantics. This is how it looks like, and you see already here on the lower part, if you compare this group with this group, TB patients, latent infected individuals, can be distinguished by the mere color. And in two studies here of 38 individuals from the latent infected group and the patients, 36 were correctly identified, diagnosed by metabolomics in the active TB 37 or 38. And here for the 48 individuals, 45 correctly identified and 44 for the active TB. So in principle, it works. You only need about 15 to 20 of these metabolites. So you don't need the whole 420 or so small molecules. You are ready to diagnose TB versus latent infection with about 15 to 20. That's indicated here. 5% error rate means 95% correct prediction. And you go here somewhere between 15 and 20. So it works in principle again. The interesting molecules for us are inosine and methionine, with anti-inflammatory activity, tryptophan catabolism with immunosuppressive activities. For the immunologists in the room, this is the degradation of tryptophan to kynurenines that's mediated by IDO, a molecule well known to be involved in immunoregulation and suppression. Fibrinopeptides, probably as a product from the fibrous wall around the granuloma, and lysophosphatidylcholines as indicators of massive cell death. Ultimately, as I said, we would like to open the holy grail, and that is find a biosignature that tells us today who of the infected individuals develops disease, who of the vaccinated individuals is protected. We are not there, but we are on our way. This is the heart of the Grand Challenge program of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations, where we have joined forces with 7 sites in Africa, 2 in South Africa, Cape Town and Stellenbosch, 1 in Malawi, a very rural site with a lot of HIV, Kampala University in Makerere University in Kampala, 2 places in Addis Ababa, and to also account for the West African site, Banjul, the MRC in the Gambia. This is where we are today. Someone coughs. The person is diagnosed as a tuberculosis patient. Important index case. More important, however, are the household contacts. The household contacts have been asked to participate in that study. If they agree, we do the following. So exposure to TB, household contacts of a TB patient newly diagnosed, are followed over 2 years. Immediately after exposure to TB, that is diagnosis of the TB patient, 6 months, 18 months, 24 months later, blood is drawn. And this is ring fence. We don't touch this, so I can't tell you any data. But we have to ring fence it because we want to use the most state-of-the-art technologies next year. Recruitment has been completed in 2010. 2 years are over in 2012 of the follow-up. So next year, actually mid-next year, we will start analyzing these samples. We already know that within these 2 years, about 3% of the infected household contacts will develop disease. So we currently we have about 75 TB cases. We hope for 100 to 110. That's always difficult to predict because you also have dropouts. These people leave and then they're gone. But anyway, currently we have about 3% non-protected diseased, 97% protected within the 2 year period. These are all high hanging fruits, but we think they are necessary. Obviously, they cost a lot of money. Currently, research and development in the whole world in private and public institutions for tuberculosis is in the order of about 500 million, half a billion US dollars. Calculations of a number of groups, including WHO, think that we need about 2 billion over the next 10 years, every year, 20 billion over 10 years. So annually about 2 billion. How can we achieve that? Well, you could call that expensive. I would call it a bargain. The cost to treat all TB cases worldwide is clearly higher than $2 billion. This is actually an old calculation, I should change it, it's much higher nowadays because of MDR, XDR, which increases the cost by 10 to 100 fold. And the total cost, if you also consider hospitalization, people not going to work because of illness, you're somewhere between 20 and 200 billion. The World Bank actually talks about half, 500 billion US dollars loss of, loss of financial losses due to TB. And also Western Europe, again, should not forget that this is also expensive for us. 50 million euros about, this is TB in Germany, Hungary 10 million, the whole EU 750 million. So even for us, this would be actually something that's quite cost efficient to put more money in the research and development to get a vaccine, a better drug, and a better diagnostic for TB. If you look at the 15 high burden countries in Europe, only two of these are within the EU, that's Bulgaria and Estonia, 2 billion. If you take the whole European region, 3 billion. That's already more for Europe than we expect that we need globally for research and development in tuberculosis. So I think by finishing, I follow Mary Lasker's advice. If you think research is expensive, try disease. Thank you.